You were asking about the factors. We just use kind of an agreement. I discovered in the very beginning of this project that where the real power in the university lies, this is a secret that's been well kept, but the Office of Financial Aids, the director there was given wide latitude in making awards of scholarship funds. The admissions director, the guidelines were rather firmly set, but he always stated in such a way that the director of admissions could make exceptions to the rules that the faculty had established. And the registrar, who could help arrange special programs and everything. These people were all very helpful and very interested in this project. And I must say, in those early, the very first group we had, we didn't know what we were doing, and we had many problems. We brought them all here for the summer, or most
before,
of them before
they started.
Yeah, and they were going to take extension courses, which had been offered for many years for kids that are going to start college, like improving your writing. And then those are the first days of the work-study jobs. So they were to have full-time work-study jobs and take these evening courses. And we got it all set up, and then I went off on a 3 weeks vacation in Europe. And when I came back, the two women that I had left in the office said, "Shall we start with yesterday and go backwards, or shall we start on the first day and go forwards?" They had been innumerable problems, including an emergency appendectomy we never thought about, health insurance. Or anything. So, fortunately, we were working with a very small group, absolutely unpublicized for the first couple of years of this program. Nothing was ever put in the paper. And
still counted on personal contacts to find applicants.
Yeah. Yes, we did more traveling in the state of Wisconsin ourselves. Worked with Upward Bound programs, which were federal programs. Also, I suppose, about to be destroyed. The people that worked in those programs were very hip to the potentially bright but disadvantaged student. So many of them came from there. And then we had this wonderful man from Chicago, Mr. Silas Purnell, who had just started as a hobby looking for opportunities for blacks. And I just happened onto him by a woman in the Office of Financial Aid was cleaning out her desk, and she came across this little slip of paper with a name and address and a phone number on it. And she said, she called me, because she said months and months and months earlier, this man had walked into her office and had said, "What special arrangements can you make for black students that don't have any money at all?" And there was nothing. So when we started the program, we got in touch with him, and he works for a small foundation in Chicago on the south side. His office is in the basement of one of those grotesque public housing projects. And he's a big, booming man. But he is still doing the Lord's work, I think. Even now, I haven't seen him in many years. But for a long time after that, the best applicants we had were the people who would say, "Dear Mrs. Doyle, Mr. Silas Purnell suggested that I write to you." He had first place, he traveled a great deal in the Midwest, visiting college campuses. He knew more about colleges than almost anybody. And he could judge better than almost anybody who would fit where and in what way. And so he was an enormous help to us. Then we had students that came from New York. We had very few residents of Wisconsin in the beginning. So we concentrated on that. We went to the schools where there were large Indian enrollments. And we went to Milwaukee North and Milwaukee Lincoln, which were the two big black high schools in Milwaukee in those days. And we sought, as I said, people from the Upward Bound programs, any other things that were going on. We sought references from them. And it just developed. And it was a marvelous experience for me. I didn't know anybody, I don't still to this day know anybody who was like me, white, middle-aged, middle class, who who had as much and as intense an experience with people of another culture and another color and another age group as I had with those students. And I still treasure them. Many of them are still my good friends, and I hear from a lot of them. And every once in a while somebody will call me up from God knows where just to say hello, and you know, it's very heartening. Many of them have been very successful. I don't think people realize generally how well so many of those students have done.
Even though they were in the bottom 1%?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a full-blown tutoring program. Each entering student had a tutor in every course. And the tutors were volunteer upper-class students. And that phase of it did not work perfectly, of course. But when it did work, it was marvelous. And when it did work, it was for the students who were disadvantaged but naturally very bright, eager, you know, dying to take the university on.
So motivation.
Motivation, it's the biggest part, probably. And a lot of very good friendships were formed. For many of the white tutors, it was their very first opportunity to talk and become well acquainted with people with dark skins and natives, that is. They probably all knew foreign students, but American Negroes were unknown, especially to Wisconsin residents.
How did you pick the tutors?
Departments would recommend them. We chose honor students. And as I say, it didn't work very well. It didn't work perfectly. It worked quite well. But in English, the students who were English majors and who were very intelligent had a hard time explaining to the disadvantaged student why they talked correctly. You know, if you sit down and think, could I teach somebody to talk correctly? Could I teach somebody to read and get meaning out of the reading that you has just been a part of you your whole life? It's very difficult. And so some of those didn't work. As I say, the bright black students got a lot out of that because they could, by being motivated themselves, just concentrate on it. There was trouble with math, and I think that was largely due to their high school background. The courses in math that they took were no good, and they, in many cases.
The high school courses.
Mm-hmm. And there were always those school staffs were so afraid kids were going to quit. You know, a kid says, I can't get math, I'm going to quit school. So they dilute and dilute and dilute the course to keep him in until he gets a diploma. And science was difficult. Foreign languages were just impossible. You know, and they often wondered, why should they have to learn French? And I must say, I had to wonder too why there was. But we never made any exceptions to the curriculum.
You didn't?
No, they were allowed to drop courses, but they met the same graduation requirements as any other student.
Did they take the same course load during the semester?
Well, no. It was called a 5-year program, and that was for purposes of selective service. Selective service in those days said you had to earn 25% each year in order to maintain your draft deferment, 25% of the degree requirements. We, with the help of Selective Service of Wisconsin and National Selective Service, and this was Tom Hoover, the registrar, who suggested, we called it a 5-year program. Our students were then only required to make 20%.
Spread out over
five years instead of 4. And as far as I know, nobody ever got drafted out of the program. We let them take it a little slower. And sometimes they dropped down to 9 credits. But eventually, almost all of them, or at least a great many of them, did graduate in the same proportions as other students graduate. Some of them dropped out, of course, and we lost track, as they do with other students. Talk about college dropouts, but you never really know whether they aren't enrolled at some other college somewhere. unless they tell you, there's no way to keep track of it. And I think these students were the same as other students in that regard. But I have met many of them. There are several of them that went through medical school, a number of them through law school. And
that's interesting. Mm-hmm. They certainly didn't settle on easy fields.
No, they didn't. And there was one particular girl that I remember from Milwaukee who wanted to be a librarian. She wanted to be a librarian when she was in high school. She worked in the high school library at Lincoln High School. And she came out of an Upward Bound program. She wanted to be a librarian. She went to library school, got a master's degree, married another young person in the program who also wanted to be a librarian. And several years ago, somebody showed me a copy of a professional library journal in which there was an article by Veronica Gillespie on who was the curator of the Theodore Roosevelt papers at the Library of Congress. And this was an article about a professional article about her work with the Theodore Roosevelt collections, which was just really remarkable.
My word.
Yeah, just marvelous.
Was she part of the very first group?
Mm-hmm, one of the early groups, yeah. Just very determined and very interested in what she was doing. Just kept at it. Not a distinguished student, particularly, I mean, in the total spectrum. Her husband did better academically, I think. He also is employed by the Library of Congress. They have two little children, live in Washington. It's really, it's just marvelous.
Very nice success story, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, there are a number of those. And so it made it very heartening. Of course, it all came smash around me, too.
Well, would you tell me how that happened? I read that it did happen, but mm-hmm. I never quite understood.
Well, I never quite understood either, as a matter of fact. I think what happened, I've always thought this would make a great drama. Me, played by Helen Hayes or somebody, against a tall, black young man named Willie Edwards who was determined to do me in, and he did. But it happened. It was going to happen anyway, I think. But the incident...
Why do you say that?
Well, I think the black people were beginning to rise up, and there was this... I had been to some national conferences. Our program was considered to be a very, very good one, and I was invited a number of times to meetings, you know, to advise and consult with groups. And I went to Washington to one group, one meeting of people from all over the United States who had programs like this, and I was appalled. They were going out just taking kids off the streets, just squashing them into colleges. The University of Illinois along in there had suddenly admitted 300 black students into its Champaign-Urbana campus without any preparation and had riots the first day. We were fortunate to have been there. I had several years of working very quietly with relatively small groups of people and establishing a supervisory staff to supervise the students and keep in touch with the tutors. You know, it's just we were established as a small group. But the uprisings were beginning to occur in various places. And here it began when I gave a speech to a little bit of a luncheon group of Democrats that meet every week somewhere in some little restaurant, and about the program, in which I said that I was opposed and would always oppose anything that would segregate these people, that we didn't need to have a black enclave on this campus. We should have an integrated student body. That's what the whole movement was about. And some students took great offense at that. That was when they were establishing. The students themselves and the black people themselves, the black power movement, the need for, they wanted a black floor in the dorm. They wanted a black student center, which what had been our office became the Black Student Center. And I must say that I was quite firm about my own positions on that. And the students that argue with me, they say, "Oh, you talk just like my mother." She thinks Roy Wilkins is wonderful. And, you know, Roy Wilkins was an old Uncle Tom to many of these young militant blacks. And so I gave this little speech, and a State Journal reporter walked in and covered it just by chance and wrote a story for the paper, which the students read. And they felt that I was doing them in. And that day, it was in the fall of 1968, it was a beautiful fall day, and they apparently marched on the chancellor's office. They were up in Ed Young's office.
Same day that you gave this speech?
No, just a few days later. And but it had been brewing for a while, bubbling along, before that even, before I gave this speech. And so I was called up to the chancellor's office, and there's this sea of black faces who were so terrifying to other university officials. Not to me, because I knew them all. You know, I met most of their mothers, and I knew them individually. And we never admitted anybody to the program without a lot of correspondence and, you know, sort of an establishment of an individual identity for each one of them. So I knew that they were just pulling my leg. One boy said, "I have friends in Chicago that are so afraid of you, they wouldn't even come to this college." I said, "Well, cut it out, you know. Don't give me that stuff. That doesn't." And, of course, there were weeks in there afterwards in which the black students were on strike for black history, black, they wanted a black curriculum, black identity, black housing, black everything. And so they had this strike here in which they made 13 non-negotiable demands, one of which was that I was to be fired. And during the course of that, was it Thanksgiving time, I think, I had gone to Chicago with my family just for a couple of days away, and I got a notice at the hotel down there that I was to be at a meeting on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, in Sam Proctor's office. He was the high mogul black man that had been brought into the president's office. He's a very able, very nice guy. And he was made chairman of a committee that was to review the program and make suggestions about changing it. So I was to be there at 2 o'clock. So I went, came back especially, and I went up there 2 o'clock on a certain afternoon. And they made me wait in the hall for a while they discussed this. There were three black students on the committee, and then some university faculty people. And the black students were running it. The university faculty was terrified of them. There's no getting around it. They were scared stiff of Willie Edwards and his wife. So after 20 minutes, they let me come in, and then he said, "You have 20 minutes to say what you have to say." And I said, "You can't mean this."
Who said this to you?
Sam Proctor, who was acting as chairman of this. I said, "You can't mean this. I've been working on this for years. There are many things about it that none of you know, and I just think it's most unfair. Nevertheless, they gave me 20 minutes, and when the 20 minutes was up, he said, "Okay, time's up, so you leave." So he left. So I left. They wrote a report that was very critical of me and demanded that I be fired. Sam Proctor put that report on Ed Young's desk and left town, and he never came back. Literally never came back until last year he came to give a speech to the Urban League. And so my days were numbered. There was no question about that. And they set up all sorts of little things. They couldn't fire me because it would have been too obvious, the discrimination on the basis of sex and age and race and everything. So they set up a committee that was going to kind of run the program. And, of course, that didn't work. And the whole work of planning next year's program stopped because it had been announced that it was going to be all reorganized, and I didn't want to be in a position of writing to all these kids that had applied for next year and explaining to them when I didn't know what the program was going to be or who it was going to be. So it became necessary at a certain point. for me to resign. And I did. And then I went to work at the law school. It was just lucky the job opened at the law school. That suited me fine. And that's where I stayed for 10 years.
And it opened at just this time.
Yeah.
Where did Sam Proctor go, do you know?
Well, he went. It was interesting. He's a professor of education at Rutgers, but he is also the pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church, Adam Clayton Powell's church in New York. He's the pastor. And every time I've been to New York, I've thought, well, I go often because I have a daughter that lives there. I've often thought I'd like to just on some Sunday morning mosey out to the Abyssinian Baptist Church and see what it's like there. Sam Proctor is a very able guy and a very realistic man. He was caught here in something that he had no experience in. He had been president of a couple of black colleges, and he had had important positions in the Peace Corps and so on. But this kind of controversy had never touched him before. And I have to feel kind of sorry for him. I remember during that period going to Chicago with him to a meeting. Every Big Ten university had a vice president like him who was black. Suddenly, you know, everybody scrounged around and found one. And they were a collection of very interesting and very able people. But I remember Sam giving him a little speech saying, look at you, here we all are. We've got great big titles. There isn't one of us here that has a staff or a budget or a line responsibility. We're just sort of window dressing. And many of them were, and I think a lot of them, of course, have left those jobs. And it was a period when it was possible in the country to take some giant steps backward, and I think we did for about a year there. This is what I guess I mentioned the other day. I'm going to do some writing on this because I think it's a part of history that's disappearing very fast and people won't remember. And it's possible, not remembering, that they'll start making the same mistakes again and dealing with it.
That could be. This sort of thing does happen.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds as though the program ground to a halt at that time.
No, temporarily. It's a functioning program now. It's quite different from what it was. I've recently had some encounters with one of the people that works there. It has a much bigger staff than it had.
Are they all black?
There's one Indian among them, I think, or a couple Indians. And but they don't. Enrollment has gone down. The financing of it is a permanent part of the university budget now, appropriated by the state, so that the recruiting is just a regular sort of routinized thing. The tutoring and all that is just voluntary, and it's that's quite different. It's more just an administrative thing there. I don't, and I suppose that would have come to us as it got bigger and bigger and bigger too. But my main concern was to get them integrated with each other and with the program and on an individual basis, you know, try to get to know every single person and, you know, so that we're aware of them. And during the strike, many of the very protective parents of these kids would take them home to Milwaukee or Chicago.
Because of the strike?
Mm-hmm. And call me up at night and say, is it safe for Joni to come back to school next week? And I'd say, you better wait a little while. It isn't over yet. Then there were two tiny little kids from Mississippi, little girls, that just made it a game. They were determined not to miss a single class. And they didn't. They went through down the coal chutes and through back windows and climbed fire escapes and everything to get in without having to cross their black picket lines, and they never missed a class.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, there were some interesting things about that whole thing, and some rather scary ones.
What kind of scary things?
Well, a girl that had lived with us a year who was a house fellow in the dorm came over one night and said that one of the freshman girls who had been at a meeting of the black students that afternoon had told her and wanted her to get the word to us that somebody had made a motion to burn our house down and that it should... and it lost by about one vote. So she came over to tell us that. Ann and I were alone. I think Jim was out of town. So we went and stayed at the neighbor's for a couple nights. And I let the word get out that we knew that this was had been reported to us. I also reported the Madison police and the campus police. And it didn't happen, of course. But the search was on for that little girl who had squealed. And they never found her. But I don't know what they'd have done. There was enough ill feeling going on in those days. Right now, I don't know what they'd have done to her if they had found her. But she was also pretty smart and cagey. But that, just think of the courage that that took for the two kids that weren't going to miss any classes. So a lot of those people, I suppose, are the ones that have turned out to be great successes because of their very strong characters.
But yes, I guess it must take something like that to overcome the obstacles and the disadvantages that they started with.
To come from, as those early kids did, from Louisiana to Madison. You know, they get so frightened just of the weather.
I suppose.
Several times kids would come in and say, I think I'm going to go home next week. Because somebody in the dorm had told them they're going to freeze to death, you know. And they might have, I suppose, this winter. But they were terrified of some of those things that we knew to be just jokes. And, of course, and then the sea of white faces, these kids from Chicago that had lived in the black communities always, found that, some of them, very disturbing. And the fact that students would ask them questions, often quite inappropriate and... improper questions in the dorms, for instance. We had to spend quite a lot of time with these kids persuading them that they have a teaching role, even though they're only 17 and they're freshmen in college. They're living among people who have never seen any, never talked to anybody with a black skin before. And so they're going to ask them dumb questions. And you can't be offended.
Sort of a reverse role of teaching.
Yeah, it really is. Was, and I suppose it still is, because I gather that there still is difficulty. The enrollment among minority students all over the country has gone down substantially. Maybe because there are many more opportunities available than there were in those days. So they're spread out thinner.
More colleges taking more students, so therefore... Yeah. There aren't as many for any one institution.
That may be. I hope that's what it is.
Certainly seems that there are a lot more blacks on the campus here at Wisconsin now than I remember during the 60s.
Yes. Yes, there are. When I left the program in 1968-69, there were about 100 and... or maybe 200 students in it. I think now they count about 500, and it stays at about that level. And they don't seem to, nobody seems to know how to counteract that. There are more Indian students, of course. There were none when we started out. And we began picking up a few. Some very interesting characters, mostly from, a lot of them from Wisconsin, but not all.
You did mention making an effort to get minorities from Wisconsin.
Yeah, we go to places like Shawnee, Minocqua, high schools where Indian students were enrolled. and never felt we had much luck. But once it got started, then gradually we'd get more and more. There have been, I think, in Wisconsin, from the law school, there probably 15 Indians graduate in the last few years, last couple of years. And before that, there was never an Indian lawyer in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, that sounds like a good step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of them remarkable, too. Some of them have turned into wonderful, successful people.
Have they gone into general practice, or do they specialize in problems with their own people?
The Indian people have never had any lawyers, you know, so that they're under a great deal of pressure to go back to the Indian communities. And I think most of them do that. I think not all, though. But they go into Indian legal programs and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of that going on. And these wonderful lawsuits, you know, with the Indians. Our son was in one of those in Maine where they claim 3/4 of the state or something.
Oh, it belongs to the Indians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From old
from
treaty.
Way back. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on in the country, as there should be, of course, I suppose.
One thing we didn't get to last time was the period of time you worked in the law school. And I'd like to discuss that this mm-hmm. morning, if it's all right. When did you start, and how long were you there?
Well, I was there 10 years, as it turned out. I started at the time that my resignation from the 5-year program. There needed to be a find a job for me, and I was not just about to fade away into the woodwork. It happened that they were looking for an assistant to the dean, and that Bill Mett, who had been assistant dean, was leaving, so that there was a natural spot for me, and I fit into it perfectly well. These were my kind of people. I'm the daughter and the sister of lawyers and the wife and the mother of 3 lawyers, actually.
Four. 3 lawyers?
Three. And our fourth child is not a lawyer, but she practices law in the legal services program. She's a paralegal, a legal associate, they call her. So I felt very much at home among lawyers. Many of course, knew the faculty there well. And it was a natural for me, and turned out to be a very happy and rewarding 10 years, I think. My job consisted of the financial aids for students, scholarships and loans, which brought me into very close contact with many, many students. And I got to know them very well. And in over a 10-year period, that means that I am well acquainted with about 2,900 lawyers that graduated from the law school during that time. I see them around at meetings now and other places, and it really is fun. I enjoyed with the students very much, found them rather surprising in a way. For instance, when it was announced that I was going to retire, several of them came in and said they envied me, second-year law students. They wished they could retire.
Already?
They had no desire to go through the whole career bit. And I don't think a lot of people recognize that. I was also the pre-law advisor, and particularly for students, although there were other pre-law advisors on the campus, for potential students who were not presently enrolled in the university, I had saw many of them, up to, I think in 1 year, about 500 appointments with people who wanted to go to law school, who were considering, had a lot of questions about law school. And, of course, that is very interesting, too. You meet wonderful, interesting people, much more diverse than you would think. Women principals of schools. One woman I remember wanted to go to law school. She was the administrator of a number of daycare centers. She wanted to go to law school because she thought she'd be better at her job. And I think I persuaded her that if she was good at her job as she was, if she needed a lawyer, she should hire one, but not devote her whole career.
Well, she was going to study law to be good at her daycare work. Yeah. I see.
And there are other things like that. But in any case, it was very enjoyable. And then the third major part of my job was the gargoyle, which was a gleam in Spencer Kimball's eye when I got to law school. He was dean at that time in 1969. But they hadn't been able to get it off the ground, and so it came in at a time that was very interesting for me. I had never done anything like this, but I set it up from the very beginning, found the printers, arranged for the format, and for 10 years published this quarterly magazine, most of which I wrote, although there were some pieces that faculty people wrote. It was well received by the alumni, and it was mailed to them, and it was on the whole a very creative and interesting kind of a job to have for 10 years. Beyond 10 years, I had the feeling it was getting harder and harder and harder to make it interesting. It was getting more difficult to keep my time schedules, my self-made deadlines, and so on. So it was, I wrapped it up in 10 years. It's still being published, but intermittently and not with as much of an investment as it was when I was working on it. Investment of money, I mean.
Now, did it begin with you, or was it in existence before?
No, it began with me. And I had a chance to do almost anything. If I was going to New York to visit my daughter, I could interview Lloyd Garrison or alumni of the law school who live in New York, or if I'm going to Chicago. I have one memorable interview with Mr. W.J. Hagenaugh, a famous alumnus who...
Of the Fountain fame?
Yes, the Fountain fame, and great benefactor of the university. Not so much of the law school. But I met him at the Union League Club. He was then 95 years old, I think. And we had a fascinating talk. He was a very interesting man. And this is the kind of person I never would have met if I hadn't had some professional, legitimate reason to call on him.
What kind of material did you have in it, other than interviews with people?
Well, things about the law school, changes, honors. We had one issue every year that included all the honors that students had won. We published the Fun Drive major report. Actually, the magazine was part of a fun drive. It was to stimulate interest of alumni in the school, and I think it probably did that. We new courses, shifts in legal education, a wide variety of subjects, all connected to the law school and to alumni. I remember one piece about couples, pairs of people who had gone to law school together or married and who were practicing law together. We had a number of those. We had some things about the early women practitioners. And I remember another story was an interview with a man named Ernie Fiedler, who was recently died, who was in the director of the National Gallery in Washington, and one of our alums, and who described for this piece the effort he made to bring the one Leonardo to the United States, which is now in the National Gallery. Apparently there's that prince in Liechtenstein or somewhere who has a vast art collection and offers things for sale from time to time when he needs money. And so Ernie Fiedler, with money given to the government by the Mellon family, went to Austria, brought the painting back with him on a commercial airline. He bought it a seat, and he fixed a container for it that would keep its temperature perfectly steady all the way through this flight.
That worked.
And brought it back to this country. surreptitiously, more or less, so that they are, well, I suppose for pictures like that, actually, although there are a number of them being stolen now, they're so recognizable that very often you don't have to worry about thieves, but nevertheless, you don't travel with a $4 million painting.
Most of it, though.
No. Oh, there are other things like that that I, you know, was able to find out about. And so it was fun. That was 10 years at the law school.
And this came out how often?
4 times a year. There were 40. 40 issues.
40 in 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work.
Yes.
Did you have somebody helping with this?
Well, just the secretary. And the last secretary I had was sort of artistic, so she helped with the layout. We were not without our critics. Faculty people thought it was very corny. Some faculty people thought it was very corny, couldn't understand why. But I resisted attempts to make it into another law review and to publish scholarly articles, which is what they would have liked, but which our alumni, whom I polled a couple of times along the way, see what they thought about it. Said they had plenty of law reviews, they didn't need any more. They liked this because it was something you would read in a half an hour and leave on the coffee table in your waiting room for people to pick up when they
come. Oh yes,
up.
I hadn't thought of that aspect, of course. People in waiting rooms aren't there hopefully too long.
Yeah.
Let's talk about financial aids a little bit. First of all, what was the situation with regard to this?
Well, it was always trouble, always in trouble. The law school has a modest endowment and a small scholarship fund and then some other scholarships that are available through the Office of Financial Aid. So that the majority of the money, the major portion of the money which students had to seek, came in loans. And the scholarships, there were a few that were granted for very particular kinds of people, but mostly we were able to keep them a little loose and give them to people on the basis of need. But the scholarship funds that we had to use never amounted to more than about a quarter, or certainly more than a third, of the financial need of the student who received the scholarship. So law school students depend very heavily on the guaranteed student loan, the bank loan that the federal government guarantees the interest payment of, and on national direct student loan. These are the things that are now in jeopardy, and particularly the guaranteed student loan, which is going to be cut back in total amount, and the interest will be raised. And the student, most of the students, I gather, will be required to pay the interest while they're in school. And of course, if you've borrowed $2,500 and 10% interest, that's $250 a year, which is a major amount in these limited budgets that many law students have. It was, I would say that half of the students, at least or more, were getting some form of scholarship and or loan, mostly loan. The job market for young lawyers has held up remarkably well, and I think even now, well, there's uncertainty in many other fields. The lawyers are still finding acceptable and appropriate and well-compensated careers available to them. When that's going to change, I don't know. But it hasn't. At least it certainly hadn't when I was there, and my understanding is that it's still very good. The market is very good. It takes a little longer to find a job now, maybe. And students often don't have the choice of 3, 4, or 5 jobs to start out with the way they used to. But in times of economic trouble, of course, the lawyers are very important. Businesses are reorganizing. Changes are being made. All sorts of legal problems are being dealt with that require the services of some of these young people. But they graduate, some of them now, I expect, with debts covering their undergraduate and law school careers of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, which seems like an awful lot of money, particularly if you're going to start out on a job that pays you $20,000 to start, which I suppose is about an average entering wage for many of the lawyers now. Of course, that is peanuts when you think that other students in other fields are winding up with heavy debt also and starting out with no income because there is no job available for them. But the I was always impressed with how well these young people managed their affairs. There were a few of them that were reckless and careless. And I, you know, being my age and my general demeanor, I can scold them good without getting hit or anything. They respect an older woman telling them off. There are some that were very careless about borrowing. Didn't seem to have any feeling that it was going to have to be paid back. But generally speaking, they were very orderly, very careful. They had many sudden problems.
Oh.
The divorce rate, the marriage rate, for one thing, was, while they were in law school, was rather high. But the number of young couples that broke up was, to me, quite astonishing.
During law school?
During law school, yes. And, of course, that creates financial crisis instantly. Yeah, that's when I get acquainted with quite a few people, when that moment comes. He or she walks out or takes all the money out of the savings account or something and is gone. Then they have special emergency problems. We have an excellent Office of Financial Aid on this campus. They've been very cooperative always and very helpful, if they could possibly be, in these sudden emergencies that develop.
Well, what was the relationship between the campus Office of Financial Aid and your activities?
Well, all of our loans came through them. Much of the scholarship money came through them. Not all of it. Some of it was administered right in the law school by the Law School Alumni Association. But there was one person in the Office of Financial Aid who devoted a substantial part of his time to the law school. So that most of this stuff, all of our scholarships, most of the loans were based on a determination of need, which was a formula prepared and used by the Office of Financial Aid, so that when we got applications for financial assistance, the Office of Financial Aid determined the need of the applicant, and on that basis we arranged for scholarship and loan. We tried to use our scholarship money to attract very well-qualified students into the first year and tried to provide more scholarship for them. Then if they came and were successful, then they could go more heavily into loans. We also had a legal education opportunities program for minority students with which I avoided being very closely connected since I had spent quite a bit of my career on that subject. But nevertheless, did deal with the financial aid of the minority students. And their situation, because of the way the state budget was drawn, made it possible for most of them to have their entire need met with grants and without having to borrow any money from any source. And that was that brought to Wisconsin a number of excellent minority students because it was a better arrangement than almost any other law school in the country.
That's good to know.
And that's permanent, as I understand it. It's a permanent part of the budget of the state of Wisconsin to make special provision for these people that had been categorically excluded. I mean, hadn't been excluded, but hadn't been able to come because of the tremendous expense and risk involved.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine that there must be a great need for minority lawyers.
Yes, and it's interesting to see it change. They've of course broadened out into many, many fields, these minority lawyers. Most of them I knew very well. And they have interesting jobs. It wasn't automatically the case, but over the years, big firms have taken them in. Many of them have worked for the federal government in a variety of ways. They've opened little law practices in Milwaukee or in other big cities. They have broadened out in a lot of different ways. And it's kind of nice to see them successful. And for instance, at a very, I suppose this isn't, shouldn't be being made note of even, but it did warm my heart to at a very kind of fancy resort up in Door County last summer when we went to dinner there to see a couple of the Leo students married to each other there having dinner in a place where I'm sure no black faces had entered very often before, and they fit right in, and it seemed nice to see them there. And I hope this year we'll see a lot more of them. They are moving around and doing well, generally speaking.
Well, that's good news. I did read that there was a Black American Law Student Association at the law school.
Yes, and it's been a very active group in selecting, encouraging and selecting LEO students, legal education opportunity students. The students themselves, the minority students, serve on a special admissions committee with several faculty people in the selection of students, take a very, very great part and a very active interest in bringing more like themselves to the law school. And that's kind of heartening to see, too. And they're very, in my experiences with them, again, I haven't been there now, it's almost 3 years, it's hard to believe, but I attended many of their meetings. They were sensible and orderly and diligent about their responsibilities in establishing this program and making it work. And so it has worked.
Well, there are a number of other topics. Let's see.
I could say something about the women law students.
Well, yes, that's while we're on. They're a minority, too, I get it.
Not much of a minority anymore. I think that it's about the law school must be 40% female now, and it went, when I first went there in 1969, I think there were under 30, maybe between 30 and 40 women law students, which made me, was a substantial change from any previous year.
But just suddenly in that 1 year?
Yeah, in that 1 year, they got to be about 30 or 40. Then, by the time I left, 10 years later, out of an enrollment of 900, there were probably 350 women. And now, of course, they represent, in most law schools, about half the enrollment, which means that employers who exclude them now are cutting themselves off from about half of the young lawyers coming out of law schools. So that that changes the whole job opportunities for them, too. It really is fascinating. But they stay girls. Last Saturday night, we had dinner with two of my husband's former law clerks, two young women, who were getting together for the first time in a year. They hadn't seen each other. And they their conversation was, they're both practicing law in law firms, one in New York, one in Milwaukee. Their conversation was, what do you wear when you go to court? Do you ever wear pants to the office and so on? You know, all sorts of girlish concerns.
Definitely, yeah. Female concerns, yes.
But it is interesting to see them.
How do you account for such a seemingly sudden upsurge?
I suppose it's the whole consciousness raising that's gone on in the last 10 years in this country. When I talked about the other day, I'm being on the county board, nobody noticed that I was a woman, or at least that I was a pregnant woman. And in the legislature, very, very shortly after I went, within a couple of days, I lost all my feminine prerogatives, and they were beating me up just the way they did each other without any particular notice of my sex. The only difference there was that I used a microphone in those days and none of the rest of them did. But that has all changed. And I don't know how you probably would have ideas too about what it is that made women change so markedly. But the need for professional training suddenly seemed to be, and for professional positions, seemed to come rather suddenly and almost naturally. Although there was some stimulation by the leading feminists, many of these women that have now gone this route, taken on heavy professional responsibilities, were not really not angry. They, you know, they're not part of any kind of movement. They're just intelligent people who now seem to take it for granted that they're entitled to a profession just as anybody else is.
Well, there has been quite a change. It seems to be more accepted that women will have responsible positions.
Mm-hmm.
And going along with this, is although perhaps it's not as common as women in professions, but men in families are taking more responsibility for things at home.
Mm-hmm. And enjoying
them. In many cases,
yeah.
Or at least in younger families.
That's right. That's right. And of course, it is both cause and effect, I think, of the rather larger divorce rate that we see. Women who are well-trained and professionally situated are in a much better position to make it on their own than women of your generation, even or mine, where you were apt to be very dependent on a spouse. So that of women who are raising children alone, and there are a number of those in the law school, are able to get positions that make it possible for them to live well, maintain a high standard of living, or a relatively high standard of living, by themselves without having to have two incomes in the family. Those were some of the women in the law school that were so impressive to me. There were several women who had never been married who were raising their children alone. There were others, of course, who were divorced. Many of the slightly older people coming to the law school were divorced women with children. They seemed to get along fine. They made use of all the services available in the city. But once in a while, you'd see a little plaintive note on the bulletin, the student bulletin board, that reflected some of the loneliness of it, such as anybody interested in a Sunday afternoon program for single parents and children, sign up here. You know, ways to try to establish some social life for themselves. And I'm sure that it was very hard work to carry the heavy burden of law school. Part-time jobs often, and raise their children. But the children, many of whom I got to know quite well.
Oh, did you?
Were lovely. I mean, I never saw, of course, I've never seen a child that isn't lovely, but these kids particularly seem to be very bright and able, affable. Of course, those strong women, the ones, particularly strong ones I'm talking about, probably make excellent lawyers, too. They're probably employable because of their strength and their determination and their brains and their willingness to work hard.
How about the men students who are married? Does this have any effect on the quality of their work?
I'm
sure. As opposed to when the students were, or the those students who were single?
Mm-hmm. Well, you often wonder. The men students, the wives, generally speaking, if there were children, the wives worked. Very often the wives were the major breadwinners in the family, although a number of the men students, of course, had part-time jobs and rather good ones in law firms or government agencies around town, so that they were contributing to the support. I used to wonder a good deal about the students that would sit in the student lounge or come down to watch Star Trek at 4:30 in the afternoon, or the bridge tables that were active during the day.
Talking about the boys who came to watch TV or play bridge.
Play bridge all afternoon. Now, I must say this is a small number of people I'm talking about who would pick up their briefcases about 5:45 and amble home. Meantime, their wives had come from work, gone to get the kids at the babysitter, and had the supper. And then they come in saying, boy, what a hard day at the law school. I often wanted to tattle on some of them. But as I say, this wasn't a very large group of people. On the whole, I think the law school students are serious and determined people. A lot of them don't find the work very challenging. And of course, there's this thing that's apparently true. Going to law school is totally different from being a lawyer. They bear no resemblance. Now, if you go to medical school, after the first year you spend a certain amount of time in the hospital, you see people who are ill, and you're in the medical world. But the law student is in a scholarly world until the day he gets admitted to the bar.
Wasn't there some effort, or is it still going on, to have some sort of internship-like program?
Yes, there is, and there's a general practice course, which apparently is very popular. In my encounters with students gave it very high marks, in which practicing lawyers came in to the law school 4 at a time to tell about practicing law, and they talk about probate and domestic relations and criminal law and so on. That's a very popular course for third year students, and the other is the clinical placements. Students are placed in various places where they work for credit under the supervision of practicing lawyers in a variety of ways. And that also is very popular.